Let's start off with a quote then to launch into the session today, which as you can see is the impact of printing. And the quote goes as follows, and I will return to this quote several times during the course of this seminar, because it's pretty much crucial to lecture to the understanding of it. When ideas are detached from the media used to transmit them, they are also cut off from the historical circumstances that shape them, and it becomes difficult to perceive the changing context within which they must be viewed. When ideas are detached from the media used to transmit them, they are also cut off from the historical circumstances that shape them, and it becomes difficult to perceive the changing context within which they must be viewed. A lady called Elizabeth Eisenstein who came up with that. She passed away aged 92 last year, 2016. But nevertheless, one of the key things that she was fascinated by and really spent most of her scholarly activity working within was this whole impact of printing. We talked last week about Walter Ong and his impact and his analysis, really, of the oral culture and how orality was very much seen as a critical aspect of our growth and development. And we've touched really over the last two sessions on what an impact Johannes Gutenberg actually had with the first ever printing press and the invention of movable type and how that impacts it. But really what we haven't looked at is what Eisenstein, not to be confused with a Russian filmmaker, Elizabeth Eisenstein, American academic and tennis player actually, which was a keen tennis player, was really beginning to analyse in probably what still remains her seminal work. It's up there, you can see it, Printing Press as an Agent of Change. How print to Eisenstein is viewed very much as the digital revolution is being perceived at present. It's really a huge game changer in terms of how communications work within society and how we communicate. What are the key areas that Eisenstein actually wants to talk about when we start talking about this printing press as an agent of change? And it's the sort of thing which Brian Winston also goes on to talk about in the thing we'll be talking about in tomorrow's seminar about technology and society, how that can also impact our understanding and change of activities and so on. Well, Eisenstein, quite simply, said that without print, none of these things would have actually happened. So no Renaissance, no rebirth of European culture, still be living in the Dark Ages, where effectively if the gods were angry with us, or the god was angry with us, we'd be suffering plague and disease, illness and so on. Certainly no Reformation, because the church would very much have a very dominant statement in terms of the organisation of society, how things were being run, how things were developed. There would be quite clearly the church, the monarchy, the rulers, the barons, and the serfs. There'd be no sort of change in terms of where things were being perceived as going. There wouldn't be anything like the whole notion of modern capitalism in terms of a financial state of play, etc. And even politics would be vastly changed because of the impact of print. Even further, Western European exploration, so the discovery of the Americas, North and South, Columbus's trips to China and so on, unlikely to have happened. Family, social, intellectual life would be markedly different from how we actually know it without print. And even though there are still folk today who don't have the gift of reading and writing, this whole notion of universal literacy would be nothing other than a myth. It wouldn't exist. It would be simply a case of, as we said in the last couple of weeks, monks, scribes, carefully writing things down and possibly translating other texts and orality basically ruling. And then, fundamentally, all of these, you've got the whole notion of the rise of the modern sciences. So why is it that Eisenstein says, without print, you wouldn't impact on these sort of areas? Well, it's summed up in one word: consistency. One of the key elements about a language in print is that things as apparently basic as spelling need to be constant. Otherwise, confusion reigns and there's all manner of changes occurring within that whole set. And so what you get is a standardisation. You get a standardisation of print in an environment where, as Caxton would develop in terms of British printing press scenarios, you could, in a room this size, quite comfortably be producing regular leaflets. Each one would be the same as the other one that was being produced, and so on. So you get a mass communication. It's the first mass medium, if you like, that means that if you wanted to actually get a number of people to read out your thoughts on a particular issue related to the church, or to a thing you wanted to advertise or you wanted to promote, you could actually sort of start advertising and promoting things, not just within your locality, but also as far as horses and such like transport would actually take you. So you could actually go beyond the walls of the village, beyond the walls of the town, beyond the walls of the city. You could actually even go beyond the walls of the country, beyond the boundaries of the country. Because as long as you're writing and printing material in a language which is French, or German, or Italian, or Latin, because Latin, of course, is a universal language, which put together even Greek, people in other countries can actually understand you. So you're gradually getting a communications mechanism which is being put into place. Let's return to that initial quote, which we keep coming back to, from Eisenstein herself. When ideas are detached from the media used to transmit them, they are also cut off from the historical circumstances that shape them, and it becomes difficult to perceive the changing context within which they must be viewed. When you're actually writing something down in a particular part of time and space, inevitably you're going to be influenced by the culture you're writing in. So what Eisenstein was concerned about, and why she was so passionate about this whole impact of print on basic culture, is that actually we kind of took it for granted. We kind of said, well, it's always there. You know, we've had print 500-600 years and so on. And it's not necessarily print that was responsible for the Reformation, or Copernicus deciding that the or observing that the Earth moved around the Sun, likewise Galileo, or that certain ways of treating particular diseases were important. It was the work that they actually did, but it neglects the notion that without print, Luther could not have actually printed his Statement of Change, he couldn't have had the Bill of Rights. Yeah. Going all the way back to the notion of actual civil rights and legal aspects. As we said, one of the things about the classic line, not worth the paper it's written on, or not written on, with a verbal contract, is this whole essence of, you know, people lie. If things are actually down in print, it will impact their lives, our lives, and so on. So actually treating print as something which is incidental, as a byproduct of what we actually see and recognise, is, according to Eisenstein, incorrect. And I got a lot of sympathy with her views from that perspective. Cue Europe in the 1300s. So we're 100 years before Gutenberg is effectively coming up with the first movable print, before that was actually there. This is a classic example of a practitioner of medicine within the 1300s, in which you would have a nosegay at the end of the beak filled with various sort of areas to prevent you actually sort of encountering any disease or dis-ease that would be forthcoming from dealing with the sick patients and so on. And you can see lots of medical professional, and this would be a standard sort of way of working through it in areas such as Venice, Italy, any sort of plague-based contract was a standard way in which you would actually deal with the plague, etc. And yet, some treatments would work, some treatments didn't work. Some people had some success, some people had no success. Some people had faith, some people had no faith whatsoever. Where was the consistency? How could we actually get information where one medic might have actually discovered a cure or a potential cure for a particular illness? How could that be transmitted? Could it be relayed via word of mouth? Well, it could be, but what happens if by the time that word of mouth has been translated two or three or four people down the line, the original message is lost? Result, disaster. You know, we hear this whole notion of the Dark Ages, the time returning to the Dark Ages and so on. Illness, disease, superstition, plague, all of the kind of key elements that come across from the human perspective. All the kind of aspects really which are uncivilized, the kind of fall of civilization, because there's no kind of system to hold things together and work through that whole process. So let's consider some of Eisenstein's precondition for print. If we take as read that actually, despite all its challenges and flaws and problematic things that we've actually got in Britain in the second decade of the 21st century, you know, we're broadly civilised. You know, we're not actually going out and sort of, you know, hunting down animals to actually get sort of various food substances and so on. We are, you know, kind of battling through. What are the preconditions for print to actually evolve and work through? Well, first of all, and it may seem absolutely obvious, if print is going to flourish, you need to have people who can read. If you can't read, then literally the symbols that are actually up there are just a wave of symbols that's actually there. It means nothing. It could be magical signs. It could be casting the runes. It could be casting the Celtic sort of symbols. It could be the I Ching that you're looking for. It's again how that laity, and laity in this particular instance refers to the majority of people in the country, often referred to as the church laity and so on. You do need to have money, because although it's relatively cheap, paper is not totally free. Scrolls and parchment, what things are you actually going to print to develop? And as we saw in that slide a few moments ago of the printing press, you need a certain amount of capital to set up a printing press to keep it working. You might also have to pay taxes to governments who actually want to charge people for the privilege of reading what you are printing. So again, there are ways forward, because actually taxes are a really good way of controlling the flow of information in terms of the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, and even 20th, 21st centuries. If you actually tax what people are actually sort of having to read or work through, and not only are you making money for yourself, you're also setting up a barrier, because freedom doesn't, because information loses its freedom. In an ideal world, everything's free. Well, not necessarily. Interestingly enough, China had also experimented with a similar kind of metallic typeface, a movable typeface. Scholars, including Eisenstein, have often said the reason it didn't quite succeed in China is because their alphabet, if you like, is very much on a pictorial situation. It's made up of pictures and lines from that, and it's less easy to actually sort of get the clear metallic sort of typeface that they were looking for. And also, it's important you have other crafts and industries being developed. Now, there is an argument that suggests that just as we're in the information technology revolution, so you've got the parallels with the industrial revolution of the 17 and 1800s. Because quite simply, if you wanted to produce a steam-powered mill or a steam engine and work through that and mass-produce things, you needed to pretty much know how to work through the process and so on. And again, it's fairly self-evident, but you also require to have some paper mills producing stuff that you can actually print on. So, let's consider this question. Again, we'll go on to what were the effects of printing on what people knew? When you allow for that whole notion of the last scholar who's regarded as being, he knew something about everything, was Erasmus. Erasmus was one of the people who was responsible for the foundation of the University of Oxford. After that, Francis Bacon kind of said, well, actually, you're reaching a stage now where there's so much information. You know, everybody in this room has certain specialist knowledge that's unique to yourself, that actually deals with your personal life, and so on. You've also got knowledge relating to your interests. It may be another victory for Grimsby Town. Or not, as the case might be. Maybe. Sorry? Yes, Port Vale, 2-1. There you go. It could be interests related to music, it could be interests related to sport, it could be all sorts of things. No one in this room will actually know everything about everything. It's just too much information actually there. You know, you might be an expert in terms of existential psychoanalysis, but hopelessly unable to actually differentiate from first principles in terms of calculus. You might know about various other things. You might be learning various other sort of processes. You might have other sort of particular areas that you want to follow through. They're just a range. I put it down as Eisenstein's top 8 impact areas in terms of how print can affect knowledge and actually affect knowledge as well as effect. Effect meaning what we actually see affects all the internal thing. There's a lot of it. You know, whether you go to a library, whether you go to a newsagent, any way, shape or form, I mean, again, there is an interesting shift now as more and more is moving online. It's interesting that feedback for your essay for this module will be completely online via Blackboard, although, as I should say, I still prefer to see people on a one-to-one verbal area to kind of go through some key areas when providing feedback. But there's a lot of stuff that's out there, so quantity increases substantially. And where there's quantity, there's an old line that I often tend to use, which was the line of a writer called Theodore Sturgeon. Theodore Sturgeon said that 90% of everything is crap. Okay? 90% of everything is rubbish, garbage. And he's actually right, because we all have our own inner bovine stuff detectors. We know when things are useful, we know when things might not be useful, or they might be, etc. In other words, you can disseminate. You can separate out what is the good stuff from what is the, well, that's interesting, but it's trivial. It's not really impacting all sorts of things. Something which was very much at the heart of Victorian England is this notion of improving yourself as an individual. It's actually really at the heart of the American dream as well, and ultimately you could say the French Revolution as well was founded on this basis of improving the self. Liberty, fraternity, equality, egalitarianism, this whole notion of putting together a declaration of rights for individuals, the right to pursue happiness, the right of individuals to pursue their own particular levels of interest. As Thomas Paine actually inscribed in the initial precursors of the American Declaration of Independence and so on, it all ties into this whole notion of self-learning. How you make that decision to improve yourself, to better yourself, to hopefully find out more. Make no mistake about it, knowledge is power. We are all privileged to actually be in an institution, in a country which doesn't effectively censor knowledge and censor power accordingly. Because ideas, which is what you get in education, which is what you get from Sam, from Doug, from myself, from any of the other tutors actually around, it actually rises that question of, is this the best way? How can we develop this? How can we work through that? And the one thing that people in power often hate are people coming up with ideas. They might say, at least we've got more ideas, because actually you need to have powers of control. So again, that whole notion of self-learning and actually finding out more about things that you're interested in and delving deeper in it. Not just having a surface gloss approach, sort of going to actually delving down into a particular subject and topic. Which also leads to that other key thing, which is so important, standardisation. Now, some might say standardisation is a bad thing. We want as many languages and as many kind of crazy systems as possible, and it doesn't really matter how things are spelled or how they're put together. You can write a press release in all sorts of ways which looks as though it's put together by monkeys typing Shakespeare out, and it still makes sense to somebody somewhere. Yes, But again, within a society, communications within society, you have to have certain standards that people accept. Otherwise, it's a bit like, to use an information technology line, garbage in and garbage out with a computer. You type stuff in, which is random. You might get some good stuff out, you may not. You do need to standardise. And something which many people actually say is one of the challenges of our present day, and consistently, I think you probably will be doing survey after survey in terms of university work, etc., which is data collection, number crunching, finding out via focus groups, via questionnaires, via structured interviews, all sorts of things, finding out what, via Likert scale, how much do you rate these students? Excellent, 5, absolutely terrible, 1, where do you put things together when you start collecting the data over particular areas? There are online surveys for every module that you'll be doing. The other end of interest from that perspective, that data then comes back to academic staff. We look at it and think, can we improve this? Can we change it? Can we adjust things? How can we develop it? How can the data collection also feel into organisation? A lot of stuff, a lot of people actually sort of don't like the bureaucracy that kind of comes as a natural byproduct of this whole notion of print and knowledge. Because without print, prior to obviously the digital age, how do you actually record this information that you're finding? How do you record if you're Gregor Mendel investigating pea plants? Does anybody know what Gregor Mendel is often known as doing? Yes, George?
He discovered a lot of genetics.
Well, he kind of came up with basically what we now know as genetics, because he spent all his time as a monk in Hungary effectively crossing different pea plants. And he came up with homozygous and heterozygous and saw different ways in which actually human beings could manipulate the characteristics of succeeding generations of plants. So he paved the way ultimately for what, a century or so later, about 80 or 90 years later, Francis Crick and James Watson did with the DNA structure, deoxyribonucleic acid. But if that original work by Mendel hadn't been written down, hadn't been recorded, if scientific work wasn't being recorded and put together, start from random. Everybody might as well go back to the cave and start learning how to actually do fire again, possibly. So again, it needs to be organised, it needs to be transmitted, people can actually see how things are going. Of course, you can also fix data. You can actually sort of have the line, which I think is often well worth revisiting, there are lies, damned lies, and statistics. And we've just come out of the party political season, where you could see all the main political parties using what statistics that they actually chose to apply to support their own particular case. The other line is you can use statistics rather like a lamppost for support to lean against or illumination to shine a light on stuff that's coming together. And in terms of knowledge itself, it amplifies things. It enables people to continually reference work that might have been done by people in times past, years past, cities past, and so on. There's a phrase called standing on the shoulders of giants, which basically refers to the fact that, you know, I stand here as someone who basically has researched, developed, put together a whole range of other factors, and that one owes a debt to everybody going right the way back to Eisenstein and Gutenberg and so on, because without their work, this would not have existed. Changes the whole sort of aspect of the whole thing. So if you don't like the seminar, don't blame me, blame Gutenberg. Or lecture. So, Eisenstein also talks about this other really important element. If in the pre-printing press centuries, the period 1300 back to start of AD, Zimbort AD, and before then BC and so on, what will we actually see? How did messages get across? Go into any of the major areas of the town, the towns and cities, and you see these massive, massive images on stained glass windows. Look at them in Lincoln Cathedral, in cathedrals, etc. All of which show stories. A picture is worth 1,000 words. So you get these massive stories that are put together, the Bayeux Tapestry, after 1066. Officially the last time that the Normans effectively succeeded in impacting in terms of British culture, and Harold effectively sort of got an eye for it. But in terms of that whole area, the messages came about through images, through tapestries that were put together, through songs. People would actually create ballads and balladeers, and they'd sing the sort of tales and the whole sort of system about that whole thing. You were very much on this whole notion of an image-based culture before you start reading things. If you look at what was a very popular sort of phrase a few years ago when cinema was in its infancy, people were saying, oh, it's not as good as the book. You know, I imagined things in the book, and when I saw it on screen, it just wasn't the same. Lots of us have had that experience, whether it's been Harry Potter, whether it's been James Bond, whomever. If you've read the book before seeing the film, then maybe you might have been disappointed, or you may not have been. You may have thought, this is great, this is a wonderful adaptation of what we've actually seen. Hollywood, as we'll go on to see in a couple of weeks' time, without print culture, would basically have been dead in the water. You know, it actually uses that intellectual real estate to adapt things, to change things around, and so on. But there's another key image that comes across, which is, again, owes so much to print culture. Crude, admittedly. And as we said, it's the initial sort of Americanization of Americas and life of that. But if you're an explorer who genuinely is a little bit concerned that the horizon is the part of the planet where if you go over the horizon you fall off the edge, how do you know that? How do you know where you're going to go? How can you actually use your sextants, your navigating devices to use more than just the stars? How can you actually get replicability? Because if you know that you're going to sail in a generally eastern direction, you'll go to Europe. If you sail in a westerly direction, sail in a westerly direction, you go to Ireland. Continue going west, nothing. Finally, you might get to Canada, North America, and so on. But it's having that sort of belief that 3 or 4 or 5 week voyages can effectively sort of lead to where do things go. And if you are, obviously, wanting information, because information makes you rich. If you were a trader in the 1500s or the 1600s or 1700s, etc., you want to know, where do you actually deliver weapons to? Where do you deliver food to? Which parts of the world are actually there? Have you all heard of Lloyd's of London? Insurers. Lloyd's Bank, etc., sign the Black Horse and all the images that come through of Black Horse. Mr. Lloyd, when he set up his business, was a coffee shop owner. And he liked people to gather in coffee shops in this public forum, and people would sort of work there and talk about things. A lot of merchants would actually get that. And he thought, that's a way in which I could possibly offer to underwrite any losses here, in terms of if a ship was sunk, maybe they could actually insure things about it. So again, it's that information of knowing where the best trade routes were, how to exploit them, how to develop them, working together with people in Holland, the Dutch explorers, the mercantile trade, and so on. It's what effectively, in the 19th century, led to over a third of the planet being under British control. Because it was spreading out that British Empire through information, through trade, through power, through knowledge, and so on. Or, because obviously you can actually trace it back to print and the impact that's having on society as well. And even the sciences, that you can't really make head and hide of what the heck that actually is. It's showing scientific sort of treaties and ways forward in which you can see things developing. As indeed you can have with this illustration. Anybody got any ideas in terms of what this is demonstrating using? It's a print of an image, a sketch, and what's it sort of demonstrating? Any thoughts? It's basically taking blood pressure. It's showing where the main veins and the main arteries actually are. It's taking a pulse. Fairly important to sort of work through this sort of process and see where things are going, how, when you sort of grip that thing at the end, you actually sort of will increase your blood pressure as well. And again, this whole notion of the medical revolution. We're shifting here from the ideas that the Greeks had that actually illnesses were caused by an imbalance in our humours. You know, we were basically made up of four different elements: earth, fire, wind, and water. Earth, fire, air, and water, or wind. And in terms of that, it was sorting things out. Sometimes bloodletting would be the way forward. You would actually have leeches in which doctors would effectively take medical leeches that you actually get, and attach to the various ends of them and bleed people away. So they actually, that was viewed as a way forward. Other times it would be a case of cut off the limbs. Now again, fairly crude mechanisms, but until people realised actually these weren't working, or these were working, it's how that sort of modern medicinal elements come into place and so on. So let's consider some of these overall effects that Eisenstein talks about with respect to society and the relationship with society. And for the penultimate time, I'll just give you this quote for the key ones, actually there, from the printing press, as an agent of change. When ideas are detached from the media used to transmit them, they are also cut off from the historical circumstances that shape them, and it becomes difficult to perceive the changing context within which they must be viewed. Well, we've already spoken about education expanding substantially. And the whole notion of education, if I was asking you to define education, I would suggest that probably the best way to start it would be to take it from the original Latin, educare, which means to lead out. What we're in the process of doing in terms of education is to lead out things that you guys already know at some level, but we're developing this whole notion of your own interests, your own values, but you're expanding that educational system. Certainly in terms of secularity and not having a major theocracy in charge, i.e. Christian, Islamic, any of the sort of aspects that are actually there, print is certainly affecting that because it's shedding those ideas. Now, I'm very much of the belief that actually it doesn't really matter whether you're a practicing Buddhist, Catholic, whatever sort of line you happen to be, that's fine. But where the challenge comes is when you believe that your route to the Almighty or to whatever is the only way forward, and then when you start getting around to saying that no, you've got a sacred text, and if you don't read the sacred text in a certain way, then it's something you can actually sort of suffer death and all sorts of things, that's when we have issues. We still have parts of America, substantial parts, who are solidly committed to the notion that everything that's said in the Bible is literally, absolutely true. Same way as people would say everything in the Quran is absolutely true, and so on. Actually, if you do disseminate the knowledge and you talk about various other aspects, you can become slightly more secular. Not to say that secularity is the solution to everything, but it hopefully will at least minimise the effect of religious wars and so on. Capitalism, well, some might say it's the biggest problem we've actually got in the 21st century. Surely the whole point about the Occupy movements in Wall Street and the campaigns that after the banks had ripped off people and the whole range of subletting and so on and so forth are all the evils of capitalism. Or is it the least worst system that we've actually got? Constantly, as many of my colleagues as well would agree, that it is wrong that you guys should have to pay for higher education. That's the system that we're actually in. Then again, you could say, well, we don't have to pay because I'm never going to get a job more than 25,000, so well, I'll just let it go then. Okay, fine, but there are ways around the whole thing. Nevertheless, let's say capitalism without print, it wouldn't have actually developed. Certainly the mass media. We talk next week about radio, television, cinema, these broad forms without print would never have developed. Samuel Goldwyn once said, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. And he was referring again to sort of film making and things from that perspective. Because again, Shakespeare clearly was writing his plays, or his wife was, or Ben Jonson was, or whatever your belief is with respect to Shakespeare, at a time where effectively the only way we can go back to Shakespeare's plays is because they were printed. Because actually he'd written down, they're printed, they're put together, we know that actually we can go all the way back to, we are glad that your father is so pleasant with us, we thank you, and so on, Henry V, and all sorts of things to interconnect with that whole notion of mass media. And you can also see how mass media can be used to manipulate people by using disinformation or information which might be used as propaganda or developing various other areas. And we see the rise of mass organised movements like National Socialism, Nazism, like Communism, areas which relate to that, all of which are developing from this whole notion of mass media being produced. And even before then, back at the start of the 18th century, the French Revolution. Anybody ever see or read Victor Hugo's Les Miserables? Or the musical, The Miserables? Yes, fine. Again, this is the terror. Sort of all actually due to the fact that ideas are being disseminated through society, through being printed out on pamphlets and pamphleteers and areas with respect to that. And so you get to that whole notion of the bourgeoisie, the notion that actually somehow the kind of decisions that are being made are set up by the chattering classes, people who kind of maybe by accident have kind of inherited wealth or done various other sort of things, etc. Again, it can be good, it can be bad. Certainly widespread literacy, most folk would actually say, is a good thing. As I said, for an awful long time, you probably had maybe a third to a half of the country who were sort of literate, could read and write. A lot of women had to lie about being able to actually read or write because they weren't allowed to effectively sort of show themselves off as actually knowing more than their husband. So if the husband couldn't read or write, then the wife might also say they couldn't do either as well. Lots of interesting surveys that come out of that from a historical perspective. Politicisation. Yes. If you have ideas about the way society should develop, the way it should grow, how it should improve and so on, and you want to spread those ideas, the only mass media form that you've actually got is print. And as I said, without print, no French Revolution, no Russian Revolution, no American Declaration of Independence, and many, many other things as well, kind of tie into the documentation that are actually stated within that. And where we actually have politicisation, you also have this sense of, well, what does it mean to be Italian, German, Irish, American, African, Australian? Where do things actually go? What's the message of that? And clearly you've got a whole other aspect when it comes to empire building about what happens to the colonials, or the colonies, when they're established, and what happens to the Native Americans, Native Australians and so on. Answer, not a great deal of good things, actually. But there is this sense about constructing a national identity, which you certainly see manifested consistently. And again, to talk about the Brexit scenario and the sort of the lines of our current sort of Foreign Secretary. Who's our current Foreign Secretary? Boris. Yes. Boris, oh my God, Johnson. They'd be all right as long as you clear up their bodies. Syria is referring to. Again, in its own way, it's setting a kind of scene in terms of what we're seeing by national identity and so on. It's also raising this whole notion of individualism. Can be dangerous, as I said at the start. How do you control a society if it's made up of individuals all doing their own thing? It's like herding cats, like sort of putting rabbits in holes and so on. Or do you actually find some workable treatment, some hegemony in which both your society folk and individuals can actually benefit as individuals and indeed benefit society as well? In other words, that you're also coming around to this whole notion of new consciousnesses. Now the key thing is, could you replace all of these with emojis? Maybe, as some scholars have actually said at present, we're heading into a post-literate society. We're actually going back to symbols and images is pretty much what we're looking for. And so there we are for individual folk who've all actually had some sort of impact when it comes to society and where we are. Without Galileo, no trips to the moon, no notion of whole aspect of physics that Isaac Newton would actually take on board. Newton clearly inspired not to invent gravity, because obviously that suggests that before the apple dropped on its head, we were all floating around like some crazy sort of folk, etc. But to actually come up with the notion of gravity as a way in which it was a force in itself, which if you could escape gravity, as indeed satellites are developed and so on, you can expand frontiers of knowledge and so on, and you won't fall off the cosmos. Critical for that. Arguably Copernicus, who was saying pretty much exactly the same thing as Galileo was saying, except he was Polish and Galileo was Italian, he was perhaps more diplomatic. Galileo was very keen to publish and say, yes, let's publish this whole thing. But Copernicus published, but kept it very quiet. And so he didn't incur the wrath of the Vatican at the time, which effectively excommunicated Galileo and banned him from the church. Actually, they did apologise after 300 or 400 years, so that's okay then. Copernicus, on the other hand, again, was kind of more seeing somebody who understood that, the way the mechanics, the politics, if you like. And Johannes Kepler, Dutch soul, who was very keen for his sword fighting and so on, Kepler had this view of the universe as being a bit like a clockwork mechanism, shared actually with Isaac Newton. The fact that actually everything was interconnected. And again, it had a religious aspect insofar as it saw God, or the Creator, as being a kind of cosmic clockmaker. Again, things have changed, and Einstein's put forward this whole range of things, including claiming the line, God does not play dice with the universe, but the theory of relativity. All of these areas that kind of impact, in certain tangential ways, the way in which we exist on the planet and the way in which we actually deal and disseminate data kind of come about, as Eisenstein would say, from these folk. So if you go back to Kepler, to Newton, to Galileo, to Copernicus, and you see the symbols that are actually here, this would refer to shorthand for Isaac Newton. This one? Kepler, exactly. That sort of mechanistic sort of line. And you see that classic line that Eisenstein constantly talks about, which is you move from ideas, communication of those ideas via the medium of print, to actual physical manifestation of ideas. There's a line which I often tend to use from a contemporary philosopher, Mike Dooley: thoughts become things, choose the good ones. It's a very important sort of way in which we're developing and seeing our things grow and develop. Again, all of those key aspects Eisenstein talks about in terms of how society is impacted by the print mass media form. And again, we'll talk about them again tomorrow. So I talked about Erasmus, and I thought we'd begin to sort of wrap up this particular stage by Francis Bacon, who, as you can see, lived about 60-odd years, thereabouts, from the 16th century to the start of the 17th century. So we've seen the Elizabethan era into James I and so on. And Bacon's often regarded as one of the last Englishmen, apart from Erasmus, who could be said to know most things about most things. So that's way back in 1626, nigh on 400 years ago, a little under 400 years ago. Think of the exponential rate in which knowledge has expanded from then. Think of the ways in which knowledge has been impacted since then. Think of the ways in which knowledge is often sort of seen as being not appropriate. Think of the book burning that often takes place. The line that works through, there's this line, you know, when ideas are detached from the media used to transmit them, do they not just remain ideas? They're also cut off from the historical circumstances that shape them. How do we actually know if we can't relate in terms of timelines to when things were being developed, when things were put together? It becomes difficult to perceive the changing context within which they must be viewed. Ultimately, I would say that quote could actually be summed up from Eisenstein in the phrase, if you don't know where you've been, you're probably not quite sure where you're going. So it's having that context of where things have actually come from, how they've emerged, and how you can revisit them to ensure that printing does have an impact. And we all say, yay, it's good. Thanks for your time. The one thing I didn't say last week, which hopefully we'll do again this week, I have recorded these and I put them up and I'll give you a podcast link. So if there's anything that sort of you want to listen back again to, you can do that as well. And tomorrow we'll talk about Brian Winston and more aspects of print.